fashion wasn't something I wanted to do. However, since this little problem about oaths and my own religious status confronts us, I'm afraid that if you and your men surrender, I'm going to have to insist on moving all of you back to the vicinity of Daros and establishing a prisoner camp there. Towards that end, you would be allowed to retain the use of all of your army's tentage, cooking gear, and other similar supplies. We would supply whatever additional needs, medical or food, you might have, and as soon as hostilities conclude, the formal release of you and all your men would undoubtedly be covered, under the terms of whatever agreement is finally reached. Garvai looked at him long and hard, and Caleb looked back levelly. He didn't know precisely what Garvai might be reading in his own eyes, but he waited patiently. Then, finally, the Coruscandian's nostrils flared.
"I understand your concerns and your reasons for them, Your Majesty," he said. "To be honest, they hadn't even occurred to me. I suppose that, like you, I have a few reservations about the validity of your excommunication. You're undoubtedly right about what would happen if I offered you my parole, though. Under the circumstances, your terms are most generous. More generous than I would have anticipated, in fact. I won't pretend it's easy, but I have no choice but to accept them, and to thank you for your generosity."
8. Royal Palace, City of Manchir, League of Coruscant. It was remarkably quiet in the council chamber. Prince Hector sat at the head of the table, Earl Tartarian sat at its foot, facing him, and Earl Anvil Rock and Sir Lindar Raymond, who had taken over the Earl of Corus's duties in addition to his own, sat to either side. No one else was present, and the prince's advisors' faces might have been carved from stone. Hector's was no better. News of the Talbor Pass surrender had arrived less than an hour ago, and the fact that everyone had known it was inevitable had made it no more welcome when it arrived. Anvil Rock, especially, looked gray-faced and ashen. It was his army which had been defeated, and his son who had surrendered.
"My prince, I apologize," the Earl said finally.
"There's not anything to apologize for, Rysel," Hector told him. "Corin did exactly what we told him to do. It's not his fault the Carizians have better weapons and control the sea."
"But he still..."
"Did you or did you not recommend relieving Barkor?" Hector interrupted. Anvil Rock looked at him for a moment, then nodded, and the prince shrugged. "I should have taken your advice. However important the man might have been politically, he was an obvious disaster as an army officer. You knew that, Corin knew that, and I knew that. But instead of letting Corin remove him, I told him to find something important but harmless for the idiot to do. Under the circumstances, and faced with those instructions from my prince, I would have done precisely the same thing he did. And it shouldn't have mattered, given the observation posts he'd set up along the coast."
"I agree, my prince," Tartarian said.
The admiral shook his head.
"I still can't see how they could have broken the signal chain so completely."
"The Armarchs, unfortunately, have this unwelcome tendency to produce highly capable kings, Terrell," Hector said with a wintry smile. "And it often seems to work out that when you get rid of one of the capable bastards, you get an even more capable one in trade."
"I don't care how capable Caleb might be, my prince," Raymond put in. "I have to agree with Earl Tartarian. I can't see how he could have done it either."
"It's almost enough to make you believe Clinton has a point about heretics and Shan Wei looking after her own, isn't it?" Hector's chuckle contained no humor at all.
"I'm not prepared to go quite that far, my prince," Tartarian said. "I am ready to concede that he has Shan Wei's own luck, though."
"I agree,
At the moment, though, how he did it matters a lot less than the fact that he did do it, and the fact that we are now well and truly screwed.
No one spoke for several long moments. At last, Anvil Rock stirred in his chair.
I'm afraid you're right, my prince, he said heavily. With Corin's field force gone, we aren't going to be able to put another one together for at least 3 or 4 months, and anything we could cobble together would be far less well-equipped and trained than the army we've just lost, even if we had the time, which we don't. According to our latest reports, Caleb already has 3 strong columns moving out from the Dark Hills across Manchir. What's left of Windshare's cavalry is trying to harass him, but not very successfully. They're managing to slow him down, but I still estimate that he'll be here outside the capital within a 5-day. The garrison we have can hold the entrenchments for a time at least, but we'd anticipated having Corin's forces, especially his artillery and musketeers, available as well. If Caleb wants to pay the price in lives, he can probably storm the works. If he's willing to settle for a siege instead, we might hold out for several months. We've stockpiled sufficient food for the city's population and the garrison for that long. But to make it last that long, we'll have to institute rationing right now. And get as many unnecessary civilian mouths as possible out of the city as quickly as possible, too.
And his navy has Manchir Bay completely sealed, Tartarian added grimly. Even if the temple were in a position to send relief, I don't see any way that it could get past the Carizian navy.
Neither one of you is telling me anything I didn't already know, Hector sighed. I think we're going to have to play for time. We might be wrong. The temple might actually have a relief fleet on its way, strong enough to do some good. I'm not saying I believe it does, I'm only saying it's possible, and that I will be damned if I surrender to Caleb Armok after this long until I absolutely have to.
The silence, after his final sentence was finally said aloud, was profound.
My prince, Raymond said finally, I believe we could still get you out of the capital. As long as you're free to rally the nobles, it's possible that... No, Lindar. Hector shook his head. As Rysel's just pointed out, our entire stock of new weapons was captured with Corin for all intents and purposes. Putting troops armed with nothing but pikes and matchlocks into the field against him would be useless. And the casualties we'd take would probably be enough to turn the survivors permanently against my house, especially after people realized I'd known how bad they'd be all along. Nor do I propose to run around like a rabbit or a hedge lizard looking for a hidey hole while Caleb beats the bushes for me. If I've lost, I'll take my chances on my feet, not cowering in a cupboard somewhere until they haul me out by the scruff of the neck.
There was another moment of silence. This time it was broken by Anvil Rock.
I hate to say this, my prince, but I believe you're probably right. Certainly you're right about the uselessness of trying to fight them with old-fashioned weapons. And I'd have to say that, based on the way he's treated his prisoners, I don't think Caleb is the sort of man to seek blind vengeance. I don't doubt he'd prefer to see you dead, especially after all of the, animosity between your house and his, and all the blood that's been shed. But if it's a choice between the pleasure of taking your head and finding the troops to control Coruscant in the face of the backlash that might provoke from your subjects, I think he'll probably forego your execution.
That's what I think too, Hector said. And don't think for a moment that I don't find the fact that I'm forced to think that way irritating.
The last word came out covered with fishhooks.
On the other hand, I'd just as soon keep as much maneuvering room as I can, and at least we've gotten Iris and Divan safely out of Coruscant.
His face tightened, the anxiety of a father who had sent two of his children into danger in an effort to protect them from still greater danger showing in his eyes, in the tightness of his lips. But then he shook himself. "I'm not planning on sending him any surrender offers any time soon," he told the other three. "As I say, there's always a chance, after all, no matter how slim. And however merciful Caleb may be feeling, I can always hope one of his own temple loyalists will get to him with a knife one fine night." 9. Emperor Caleb's Tent, Duchy of Manchir, League of Coruscant.
"Should I assume, Colonel," Emperor Caleb asked coldly, "that you have somehow failed to grasp my intentions in this matter?"
Colonel Bartol Rogier had the appearance of a man who wished he could be anywhere else as he stood in Caleb's command tent facing an irate emperor. The commissary officer was effectively the chief quartermaster for Caleb's army, and, by and large, he'd done an outstanding job so far, aided by the Carizian Navy's ability to move large quantities of supplies quickly by water. At the moment, however, he clearly didn't expect his past accomplishments to loom very large in Caleb's thinking.
"No, Your Majesty," he said.
"In that case, perhaps you could explain to me why my instructions haven't been carried out."
Caleb's voice was even colder, and Rogier swallowed unobtrusively. Then he stiffened his shoulders and faced the Emperor squarely.
"Your Majesty, they don't believe us."
"Who doesn't believe us? Your assistant commissaries?"
"No, Your Majesty, the Coruscantians. The Coruscantians don't believe you're serious."
Caleb's eyebrows rose, and Merlin found himself hard-pressed not to chuckle as Rogier faced his emperor with an expression which was part pleading, part confusion, and part outraged virtue. Unlike most Safeholdian commissary officers, Rogier was actually honest. By tradition, most commissaries took a 10% bite off the top of all funds which passed through their hands. In most kingdoms, that was considered one of the perquisites of their position. In Caris, that wasn't the case, and Rogier had never shown any temptation to emulate his more sticky-fingered counterparts in other realms. In addition to his honesty, he possessed the virtues of intelligence and energy, but he was an outstanding example of what had once been called a bean counter back on old Earth. He was organized to the point of fanaticism, and he was one of the people who'd seized upon the introduction of the abacus and Arabic numerals with both hands. Outside the regulations and requirements of the commissary, however, he had about as much imagination as a boot, and he was possessed of a strong sense that things should be done the way they'd always been done, only more efficiently. Now Caleb settled into the camp chair beside the table at the center of his tent, looking at Rogier, and the commissary officer clasped his hands nervously behind him.
"What do you mean, they don't think I'm serious?"
"Your Majesty, I've tried to explain it to them. They just don't believe it."
Merlin wasn't really surprised to hear that. Caleb and his commanders were busily seizing every bag of rice, every basket of wheat, every reaper, and every horse, cow, draft dragon, chicken, and pig their foraging parties could locate. That didn't surprise the locals, however much they might have resented it. Stealing food and plundering farmers were what armies did, after all. Expecting them not to would have been about as reasonable as expecting a hurricane not to rain, although with this particular army there had been remarkably little of the rape which often accompanied that plundering. In this case, however, Caleb wasn't collecting the food and other supplies for his own army's sustenance. He was collecting those items primarily to deprive Hector of them, although he was also quite willing to use the confiscated food to feed the prisoners who'd once been Sir Corin Garvey's army. That particular difference in approach had absolutely no significance for the unhappy original owners of the food, animals, and agricultural equipment involved. What did have a certain burning significance for them was that, contrary to the practice of virtually all other armies, the Marines were actually issuing receipts for the private property which had been seized. Receipts which would be redeemed in cold hard cash at the end of the campaign. At which point Caleb fully intended to tap the treasury currently in Hector's possession in order to pay for them. It was a novel notion, and one which had occurred to Caleb entirely on his own. As he'd pointed out, one of the better ways to defeat the Group of Four's propaganda was to earn the trust of those people actually in contact with Karras by concrete deeds instead of printed broadsides.
"Let me get this straight," he said now. "You're telling me the Coruscantian farmers are refusing to accept the receipts our foragers are handing out?"
"More or less, Your Majesty."
Rogier shrugged slightly.
"Some of them take them, but they don't make much effort to keep track of them. And others, I'm afraid, are selling them to anyone foolish enough to offer them hard cash on the spot for them."
"At what sort of exchange rate?" Caleb asked, his eyes narrowing.
"Most of them are prepared to settle for 100th piece on the mark, Your Majesty," Rogier sighed, and Caleb's jaw tightened ominously.
"And are these so generous speculators Carizians?" he inquired icily.
"Some of them," Rogier admitted. "Possibly most of them. I really don't know. I only know the locals don't think our receipts are worth the paper they're written on. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if some of them are using them in their outhouses, Your Majesty."
"I see."
It was obvious to Merlin from Rogier's expression and body language that he, personally, believed Caleb's quest to actually reimburse the citizens of a land with which he was currently at war was quixotic at best. In fact, the commissary seemed to find the entire notion almost immoral, an unnatural act on a par with incest, perhaps. He wasn't about to come out and say it in Caleb's presence, but it was pretty clearly his opinion that if the Coruscantians chose not to accept or hang on to the receipts they'd been offered, that was their lookout, not his.
"Listen to me carefully, Colonel," Caleb said after a moment. "The policy of the Imperial Navy and the Imperial Marines is going to be that we pay civilian owners for what we seize from them. Civilian owners, Colonel. I'm not going to pay a pack of greedy Carizian speculators instead of the people whose property we actually took."
"Your Majesty, I understand that, but..."
"I wasn't quite finished speaking, Colonel."
Rogier's mouth closed with an almost audible click, and Caleb favored him with a frosty smile.
"I'm afraid your clerks are going to find their workload just got a bit heavier," the Emperor continued. "From this moment on, receipts for confiscated property are not transferable. They will be honored only when presented by the individual to whom they were initially issued, or, in the event of his death, his legal heirs. Is that understood?"
"Yes, Your Majesty, but... how are we going to be able to prove the individual presenting the receipt is the one who actually received it in the first place? And what happens if someone loses a receipt?"
"That's why your clerks are going to be working a bit harder, Colonel. First, I want a duplicate copy of every receipt we issue, complete with date, time, and place, filed by every foraging party every day, in addition to the entries in your ledger books. And I want the recorded names of at least two witnesses to attest that the name of the individual to whom the receipt was issued is correct on the receipt. Those same two witnesses will be available to identify that individual before a dispersing officer, if that's necessary.
Rogier's face had grown steadily longer as he visualized the additional labor involved, but one look at the Emperor's expression warned him against arguing. Caleb let him marinate for several moments, then leaned back in his camp chair and cocked his head.
"Was there anything else we needed to discuss, Colonel?" he asked pleasantly.
Rogier shook his head almost convulsively, and the Emperor smiled.
"In that case, Colonel, I won't keep you any longer. I'm sure you have a great many things that need doing."
10. Royal Palace, City of Telesburg, Kingdom of Karras.
"Are you sure this is a good idea, Charlian?"
Empress Charlian paused, her wine glass halfway to her lips, and her eyes narrowed as she cocked her head at the Duke of Halbrook Hollow. Her relationship with her uncle hadn't so much improved over the past few months as settled into one of mutual exhaustion. He continued to make no pretense about his disapproval of her marriage and decision to embrace Karras's cause against the temple as her own. Nor did either of them pretend any longer that Charlian hadn't brought him with her to Telesburg specifically because of that disapproval. Despite her conversation with Archbishop Michael, their estrangement caused her more pain than she could possibly have expressed, and she made a conscientious effort to at least maintain their familial relationship, since it was obvious their political relationship had been largely destroyed. She knew he still loved her, and they both pretended during their twice-a-five-day suppers together that politics didn't exist. Which made his question unexpected, and also explained why she found herself fighting to suppress an instinctive spike of automatic, resentful exasperation.
"Which idea, Uncle Bertram?"
She worked hard to keep that exasperation out of her tone, but it was far harder to dissemble with someone who'd always been so close to her, and his lips tightened for just a moment. Then he sat back from the table and propped his elbows on the arms of his chair.
"Actually, Charlie," he said, using her childhood nickname for the first time in far too long, "I wasn't talking about any of your, political decisions. Or not specifically about their political aspects, at any rate."
He smiled thinly, but with an edge of affection.
"I was talking about this field trip of yours."
"Oh, you mean the one to St. Agatha's?"
"Yes."
He shook his head.
"I'm not happy about it, Charlie. In fact, I'm starting to regret ever having mentioned the convent to you in the first place. There's too much chance for something to go wrong if you insist on visiting it."
"I think that between them, Colonel Ropewalk, Willis, and Edward are quite capable of dealing with anything that does go wrong, Uncle Bertram."
"I know you think that, and frankly, I hope you're right and I'm wrong. But I think perhaps I may understand the feelings of those who don't wish to see this schism prosper a bit better than you do."
He shook his head again as her face tightened.
"I'm not trying to open that entire jar of worms, Charlie. Promise."
He managed a crooked smile, and she relaxed again. Mostly.
"I'm simply saying that emotions on either side are passionate, and what with the interdict and the excommunication, those who wish you ill are altogether too likely to feel justified in taking some sort of desperate action. Caleb may be safe with his army, but you aren't. I don't want to see you taking unnecessary risks."
"Thank you," she said, her eyes warming at his concern for her safety, despite the differences between them.
"But I'm not going to allow fear of my own subjects to turn me into a prisoner in the palace. I especially can't afford to do that while I'm still that foreign woman to altogether too many of them. This field trip, as you call it, is one way of showing them I trust them enough to travel among them. And the fact that St. Agatha was born in Chisholm, but chose to spend almost all of her life here in Carus, won't be lost on them either. Besides, I've been fascinated by her biography. I really want to see the convent where she worked all those miraculous healings. And, she did not add out loud, because I'm exhausted. I think Regis, Michael, and I have done a good solid job of hammering the Imperial Parliament together. And I can't believe how well Michael's managing to integrate Archbishop Powell's archbishopric into the new hierarchy, even with Brainerd's active cooperation. But it didn't come easy for any of us. And people like your good friend Kyrie didn't exactly help either, Uncle Bertram. I need this trip. All that may be true, he replied, but it doesn't change a single thing I've said either. I wish you'd at least take more of your personal guard from home with you. I can't do that either, Uncle Bertram. Her tone had hardened slightly, and she grimaced, unhappy with herself at the change. The last thing I can afford to do, she continued, trying to soften her impatience, is to give the impression that I trust Chisomians more than I trust Carisians. That's the entire reason for integrating my guardsmen and Caleb's in the first place. But, Uncle Bertram, she interrupted gently, I appreciate your concern. I truly do. Believe me, the fact that I know you still love me, despite our present political differences, is more important to me than I can say. But as you yourself helped Marak teach me when I was a girl, once a decision's been made, the worst thing you can do is try to second-guess yourself. And let's be honest with one another, please. My reasons for the decisions I've made can't possibly be acceptable to you. I know that, and I regret it, but it's a fact we both simply have to accept. And that means you're looking at all of those decisions from a radically different perspective. Of course, we're not going to agree. If you'll forgive me, I think we both need to take it as a given that you're motivated by your love for me to worry about my safety, but that I can't allow your worries to change my mind. And on that basis, I think it would be far better if we agreed to discuss something else. He gazed at her across the table for a second or two, then sighed. All right, Charlie, he said. You're probably right. And speaking of discussing something else, he continued in a determinedly brighter tone, what do you think of that new chestnut of mine?
11. Emperor Caleb's Headquarters Encampment, Duchy of Manchir, League of Coruscant. Merlin Athrawes sat in the darkened tent, leaning back in a folding camp chair with his eyes closed. He really ought to have been lying down, with his breathing programmed to be slow and deep, pretending to be asleep if anyone should wander in. But that was much less likely to happen here than it had been aboard ship. Besides, he'd discovered that he actually thought better sitting or standing, which had to be purely psychological, but made it no less true. Unfortunately, the posture in which he chose to do his thinking did nothing to add more hours to the lengthy Safeholdian day, and as he'd told Caleb, there was simply too much he had to keep track of. Initially, that hadn't been that much of a problem, but as the repercussions of Karis's defiance of the Group of Four re-echoed around the globe, it had become a nightmare task, even with Al's help. The fact that he'd been forced to concentrate so heavily on Coruscant, once Caleb began active operations against Hector, had only made the nightmare worse. And when he dropped a stitch, the consequences could be dire. Not to mention frustrating as hell. He was still, irritated with himself for not picking up on Hector's plans to get his daughter and younger son out of Coruscant in time, for example. The fact that the schooner Dawn Star had actually stopped and boarded the ship with the two of them and Earl Corus aboard only made his irritation worse. If there'd just been time to warn Dawn Star and the other cruisers that some suitably anonymous informant had told them members of Hector's family might be attempting to flee the princedom, then her boarding officer would undoubtedly have taken a much closer look at Wing's passenger list instead of concentrating on her cargo. Her completely legitimate-seeming cargo. Still, he had to admit that Caleb had been right to order him to take regular breaks each night. 2 hours was probably more than he actually needed, but he could recognize a significant difference in his mental sharpness since Caleb had handed down his diktat. His lips twitched in a smile as he wondered just how Caleb would be able to tell whether he was awake or asleep if the Emperor came to check and make certain he was getting the prescribed downtime each night. I suppose the point is that he doesn't have to check. I told him I'd do it, and he took my word for it. Sneaky bastard. It's so much easier to creep around behind the back of someone who doesn't simply expect you to be as honorable and trustworthy as he is. Besides, I might as well admit that he's got about as much command presence as anyone I ever served under, including Commodore Pei. It was peculiar how his original attitudes towards Karis and Carizians had changed, he reflected. He'd respected both Caleb and his father from the beginning, but as he'd told King Harald in their very first interview, his loyalty had been to the future of Safehold, not to any specific monarch or even realm. Yet that was no longer strictly true. Since then, somehow, he'd become a Carizian himself, and he wasn't certain that was a good thing. His responsibility was to the entire human race, not to the House of Armagh, however personable, likable, and charismatic the current head of that house might be. He couldn't afford to allow himself to begin identifying with the interests of Karis in a way which might distract him from his overarching duty. "But I'm not really," he told himself in one corner of his brain, while most of his attention was concentrated on the summary of the day's take from the Snarks, which Owl was transmitting to him. "Or rather, at this point in time, the interests of Karis are identical with those of the human race in general. There's certainly no one else prepared to take the stand Caleb, Michael, and Charlian are taking, at any rate. Even from the most cold-blooded perspective, I can't afford to lose this particular team. If I did, I'd probably never find its equal again." "Sure," another corner of his brain replied sardonically. "You go right on convincing yourself that way." "Oh, shut up," the first corner snapped peevishly. He snorted. These little internal conversations of his would undoubtedly have worried any psychologist who'd been prepared to take on the challenge of analyzing an electronic pattern of memories and emotions which stubbornly persisted in thinking of itself as a human being. It wasn't as if... His thoughts broke off abruptly, and he twitched upright in his chair. "Owl," he sub-vocalized.
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander Alban?"
"Replay that last segment."
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander," the AI replied obediently, and Merlin swore silently and viciously as a dagger of ice seemed to go through his non-existent heart.
"Damn it! Damn it! I told Caleb I had too many things to do."
Yes, he had, and as Caleb had suggested to him, that was as inevitable as the next sunrise. He simply had to prioritize, which was why he'd been concentrating on matters here in Coruscant and events which might directly impinge on Caleb's operations. Besides, he knew the quality of the people Caleb had left behind in Telesburg, and he couldn't have personally affected anything that happened there from this far away anyway. Every single word of that was true, and he knew it, which didn't make him feel a single bit better. He stood abruptly, still watching behind his eyelids, as the Snark, routinely sweeping Charlian's physical location and tracking her movements, detected the armed men moving steadily towards the convent of St. Agatha. He didn't know who they were, but he knew they weren't her guardsmen or anyone else associated with her security force. That only left one real possibility for why they might be closing in on the convent. Obviously, he'd missed even more than he'd realized. Neither he nor Owl had tagged any of the men the Snark was watching as potential threats. They weren't even in the database they'd been constructing. But they had to have contact with someone who was, or else they wouldn't have known Charlian's agenda well enough and sufficiently in advance to prepare as well as they obviously had. Those thoughts flashed through his Molly Cirque brain, and then he shook himself. However interesting all this speculation might be, it wasn't doing him any good, and it wasn't doing Charlian any good either. He stood very still, considering alternatives and consequences. It was roughly 4 in the morning in Coruscant, which made it 1800 in Karis, and he was the next best thing to 7,000 air miles from Telesburg. There was no way he could possibly warn Charlian or any of her guardsmen. But there was one possibility, only... It's those kids and the Krakens all over again, he thought. Only this time it's even worse. I can't do this. I can't risk this. It can undo every single thing we've accomplished so far, and I don't have any right to run that kind of risk, however much I want to. He knew he was right, knew he couldn't take such an enormous chance. Knew... Get the recon skimmer airborne, he snapped to Owl. 12. Convent of St. Agatha, Earldom of Crest Hollow, Kingdom of Karis.
I think the Abbess expected me to object to the rule about servants, Charlian commented, as Father Carlson, Captain Geratt, and Sergeant Seahamper escorted her from the refectory to the convent of St. Agatha's guesthouse.
If you'll pardon my saying so, Your Majesty, you ought to have objected, Geratt replied, just a bit sourly. It's not fitting.
Oh, stop fussing, Willis, Charlian scolded affectionately. I knew about the convent's retreat rules before I ever asked the Abbess to allow me to come. And my imperial dignity isn't so fragile that it has to be buttressed every moment, especially on a retreat. Besides, a reputation for piety isn't a bad thing under the present circumstances, now is it?
And you expect me to believe you decided to accept the convent's stipulations solely on the basis of cold calculation? Is that it, Your Majesty?
No. But if doing what I think is the right thing works out to be the same thing I would have decided to do if I had calculated coldly, I'm not going to object, Charlian replied serenely. I'm relieved to hear that you have your priorities in order, Your Majesty, Father Carlson said dryly, and Charlian chuckled. I'm glad you're relieved, Father. On the other hand, I was scarcely likely to come up with any other answer where my confessor might overhear it, was I? Except that such duplicitous thinking would never occur to someone who's had the advantage of my spiritual counsel for so long, Your Majesty, he replied tranquilly.
Oh, of course not, she agreed, then looked back at Geralt. At any rate, Willis, the convent's rules are the convent's rules, and I don't intend to argue with them.
And how many years has it been since you put yourself to bed?
The commander of her guard detail demanded.
If you want to be technical about it, I don't suppose I ever have, except on religious retreats, which I suppose I could point out, if I were the sort of person who liked to repeat herself, is what this particular excursion happens to be now, isn't it?
And you expect me to believe Sarai was happy to hear about this, Your Majesty?
The captain asked skeptically.
While I realize this may be difficult to believe, Willis, Sarai has learned to accept, unlike certain Imperial Guard officers I might mention, if I were the sort of person who did that, that upon occasion I may actually decide to set my royal dignity aside. And amazingly enough, she doesn't argue with me about it.
Geralt might have growled something under his breath, but if he had, he'd done it quietly enough Charlian could pretend she hadn't heard it. And at least he hadn't called her on her bald-faced lie. While it might technically be true that Sarai Hallman hadn't said anything against her Imperial Charge's decision to leave her behind aboard HMS Dancer, she'd certainly found ample opportunity to make her feelings clear. She probably could have supported herself quite comfortably as an actress, assuming she could have resisted the temptation to overact, which, judging by this morning's performance, was unlikely.
"I at least wish Lady Mera were here,"
the captain said aloud.
"And if she hadn't taken that tumble and broken her leg when she and Uncle Bertram went riding, she would have been," Charlian pointed out.
"You could have asked one of the other court ladies," he began.
"I'm going to be just fine, Willis," she said firmly. "And I don't intend to spend all night arguing with you about it."
He gave her one more disapproving glance, then drew a deep breath, puffed out his mustache for a moment, and nodded. The Empress shook her head affectionately. Like most of her guardsmen, and of course Sarai, Geralt was far more sensitive to the demands of her royal dignity than she was. Perhaps that was because it was her royal dignity, well, imperial dignity these days, and not theirs. She'd learned very early that she couldn't afford to allow her dignity to be undermined by the real or apparent slights of others. Whether or not she wanted to be hypersensitive in such matters was actually beside the point, given the importance of appearances in the world of political calculations. Yet a reputation for humility could also be valuable, under the appropriate circumstances, and the opportunity to step back from her persona as queen or empress, even briefly, was literally beyond price. That was one reason she'd been fond of occasional religious retreats ever since the day she'd assumed the throne of Chisholm. The opportunity to slip the day-to-day secular demands of her crown and spend some time contemplating the demands of her soul instead had always been welcome. And the opportunity to stop standing upon her dignity, however fleetingly, had been almost equally welcome. Geralt and Seahamper knew that as well as she did, and they'd had conversations very like this one many times in the past. It was an old and familiar topic, and her uncle always tended to weigh in on their side, shaking his head and wondering rhetorically why she hadn't simply gone ahead and taken vows herself. She smiled at the memory, but the smile was brief as she remembered their estrangement. He hadn't accompanied her to St. Agatha's, although she'd invited him, hoping the opportunity might draw them closer once more. His refusal had been polite but firm, and she wondered if it would have hurt less if she hadn't suspected that he'd sensed the same possibility and wanted to avoid it. They arrived at the guest house, and she reached out to lay an affectionate hand on Geralt's arm. "You, Willis Geralt, are a fuss budget," she told him.
"As your majesty says."
The stiffness in the guardsman's voice was belied by the twinkle in his eye, and she squeezed his mailed forearm.
"Exactly. I'm the Empress around here, after all.
And I assure you, I'll manage just fine in my lonely little convent cell.
If I should suddenly discover that I'm physically incapable of getting myself into bed, I know that all I have to do is call out, and my stalwart guardsmen will charge fearlessly to my rescue."
"Your Majesty, physical danger is something any guardsman is pledged to face on your behalf,"
Geralt said gravely.
"I'm afraid helping you prepare for bed isn't."
"Coward."
She smiled, then took her hand from his elbow and glanced at her confessor.
"Are you ready for bed, father?"
she asked, and he nodded.
"There, you see, Willis? I'll have at least one loyal soul close at hand if I should suffer some terrible nightmare."
"And I'm very happy for you, your majesty," he assured her.
"Thank you," she said, and stepped through the guesthouse door.
The priest stayed long enough to exchange commiserating smiles with her armsmen, then followed her inside and closed the door behind him. Geralt and Seahamper exchanged silent but eloquent glances of their own, then shrugged as one.
"Captain, you're not going to change her at this date," Seahamper pointed out.
"Of course I'm not, but she'd be disappointed if I stopped trying, and you'd know it."
Seahamper chuckled, then looked around the convent grounds. St. Agatha's was located in the Stiven Mountains, above the earldom of Crest Hollow's Tricare Bay, on the narrow isthmus dividing Howell Bay from the Cauldron. The voyage from the capital aboard Captain Patrick Hywitt's 56-gun galleon HMS Dancer had been a welcome diversion. The ride up the narrow, twisting track which served St. Agatha's and the farmsteads around it had been rather more strenuous, but still enjoyable, and the convent's elevation was sufficient to actually give the gathering evening a bit of a bite.
"Probably just my imagination," the sergeant thought. "I'm a northern boy, and I think I've been away from home way too long if this feels chilly to me." "Any special concerns, sir?" he asked Geralt after a moment.
"No, not really,"
the captain replied, carrying out his own survey of the convent.
"In some ways, I wish she'd listened to the Duke and brought along even more men. But I think we're in pretty good shape, Edward."
"Yes, sir,"
Seahamper agreed.
"All right, then," Geralt said more briskly. "I'll make one more check of the perimeter, then hand over to the lieutenant and turn in. Call me if you need me."
"Yes, sir,"
Seahamper said, exactly as if Geralt hadn't told him exactly the same thing scores of times before. The captain smiled at him, then headed out into the gathering dusk. Thunder rumble-grumbled from the west, and Seahamper grimaced. It rained a lot in Caris, especially by the standards of someone who'd grown up in Chisholm. From the sound of things, it intended to do some more of that raining tonight. Willis Geralt heard the same sound of thunder as he stepped out through the convent's open gate, nodded to the 10 men posted there with Lieutenant Hoskin, his Carisian-born second-in-command, and turned to his right. The ancient stone wall around the convent proper was more for privacy than any sort of genuine security. He was glad enough to see it, he supposed, but it would have been far more useful if it had been either a little shorter or else enough wider and taller that he could have put men on top of it. As it was just high enough that the men on the outside were effectively separated from those on the inside, and that they'd have to use one of the three gateways to get past it in any sort of a hurry. The main gate in the southern wall was wide enough for heavy freight wagons. There were smaller, merely human-sized gates in the western and northern walls, and all three of them had stood open when the Imperial Guard's advance elements had arrived. They'd promptly collected the keys to the smaller gates from the Abbess, who had surrendered them readily enough. However intractable she might be about the convent's rules where servants were concerned, she clearly understood the realities of providing proper security for her empress. And, Geralt reflected gratefully, despite the fact that she'd been the abbess of St. Agatha's for almost 20 years, she was obviously one of the Carisians who had enthusiastically embraced the Church of Caris as well. He'd been more than half afraid they'd been going to encounter someone with Temple Loyalist sympathies. He reached the corner of the wall, made another right, and started through the fruit orchard outside the western wall. The abbess had been a bit dismayed by the size of Empress Charlian's guard detail. Convents weren't exactly accustomed to playing host to men with weapons, and her housing arrangements hadn't been up to the arrival of 80 armed and armored Imperial Guardsmen. She'd attempted to hide her dismay when they turned up, but she'd obviously had no idea where to put them, and she'd gratefully accepted Geralt's suggestion that perhaps his men might camp in the meadow just beyond the orchard. A deep, rapidly flowing stream offered plenty of fresh water, and the location was convenient to the convent's inner grounds by way of the smallish western gate. The fact that its location also happened to give some additional security to that gate was simply a welcome side effect. At the moment, half the detail was preparing to settle down in tents and bedrolls. In 6 hours, they'd be roused to relieve the duty watch, and he hoped their ability to sleep wouldn't find itself too sorely taxed if the evening's weather turned as interesting as it was threatening to do. No guardsman would ever be encouraged to sleep too deeply, but adequate rest was important if they were going to stay alert in the middle of the night, and thunderstorms were seldom exactly restful for men sleeping in canvas tents. The 8-man watch on the western wall was satisfyingly difficult to spot. Two of its men were easy enough to find, openly sweeping back and forth along the foot of the wall with their bayoneted rifles on their shoulders. The other 6, however, had found proper concealment, allowing them to maintain their overwatch without revealing their own positions to anyone who might happen by. The sergeant in charge of the detail emerged from the shrubbery to salute as Geralt walked by, and the captain returned the courtesy. The northern wall's duty section was equally alert, equally focused on its responsibilities, and Geralt felt a deep pride in all of his men. Half of them were Chisomians, the other half were native-born Carisians, and without actually hearing their accents, it would have been impossible for any outsider to pick them out from one another. There'd been a certain amount of friction when the guard details were combined to form the new Imperial Guard, but these were all elite troops. They'd settled down quickly, united by their responsibilities and their pride in the fact that they'd been found worthy to guard the Empress from harm. He started his swing along the eastern wall, heading back towards the southern wall and the main gate. This was the shortest of the convent's walls, and he was just as happy that it was. The last of the sunset's bloody light, oozing ominously through the narrow chink between the storm clouds and the Stiven summits, was fading quickly, and the trees on this side of the convent, mature growth forest which had never been logged off, unlike the neatly ordered fruit trees of the orchard, stood back 50 or 60 yards from the wall. The shadows underneath them were already impenetrable, and they loomed like a dark, vaguely sinister barrier, or some sort of crouching monster. The thought made Geralt uncomfortable, and he brushed it aside impatiently as he finished checking the last post on that side and headed for the front gate.
"You've got entirely too active an imagination, Willis," he told himself firmly. "That's probably better than being too stupid to worry about the obvious, but it's not exactly..."
The steel-headed arbalest bolt that came hissing out of the darkness under those trees struck him squarely in the throat and interrupted his thoughts forever. 13. A farmhouse near St. Agatha's, Earldom of Crest Hollow, Kingdom of Caris. Bishop Miles Halcombe forced himself to sit serenely at the roughly made table in the farmhouse a mile and a half from the convent of St. Agatha. What he really wanted to do was to pace furiously back and forth, expending physical energy in an attempt to work off the nervous tension coiling deep within him. Unfortunately, he couldn't do that. If all was going according to plan, the attack on the convent would be beginning shortly, and he closed his eyes in a brief, silent, heartfelt prayer for the men out there in the gathering darkness who had accepted God's stern demands. The irony of the fact that such a brief time before he would have been horrified at the very thought of praying for success in a mission like this one wasn't lost upon him.
"My lord, we have a visitor."
Halcombe opened his eyes and looked up quickly as the tension in Alvin Shumay's voice registered. His aide stood in the farmhouse kitchen door, and his expression was anxious.
"What sort of visitor, Alvin?" he made himself ask calmly.
"Me, my lord bishop," another voice replied, and Halcombe's eyebrows shot up as the Duke of Halbrook Hollow pushed past Shumay.
"Your grace," the bishop said after several taut, silent seconds, "this is not wise."
"With all due respect, my lord, I'm not all that concerned with wise when we're talking about my niece's life,"
Halbrook Hollow replied flatly.
"And how do you intend to explain your presence here, your grace?"
"I won't have to. Everyone knows Charlene and I don't see eye to eye politically any longer. No one's going to be surprised that I preferred not to sit around in Telesburg when she was away. After all, it's not as if I have a lot of friends there, is it? Officially, I'm visiting Master Kyrie, and the two of us are staying at his hunting lodge. I'll be back there and waiting by the time official word can reach me."
"My lord, you've run too many risks."
Halcombe's voice was even flatter than Halbrook Hollow's had been.
"How many people know you're here?"
"Only a handful," the Duke replied impatiently. "Kyrie, my personal armsman, and the crew of the schooner that brought me."
"Excuse me, my lord,"
Shumay put in, momentarily drawing both of the older man's eyes to him.
"But his grace used sunrise."
Halcombe's eyes narrowed for a moment. Then he tossed his head in an odd cross between a shrug and a nod as he realized Halbrook Hollow hadn't been quite as rash as he'd originally believed. Trevir Kyrie's unhappiness over the sudden infusion of questionable innovations which had flooded Caris, his matching unhappiness and disgust with Caleb's and Michael Stainer's decision to openly defy the temple and the Grand Vicar's authority, and his wealth and political prominence had all combined to make him one of Halcombe's first cautious contacts when the bishop arrived in Telesburg. He'd responded quickly and firmly, with a fierce promise of support, and he'd also accepted Halcombe's direction and moderated his open public anger and disgust. Neither of them had been foolish enough to think he could suddenly pretend he actually supported all of the blasphemous changes taking place around him. But he'd made it abundantly and firmly clear that he had no intention of trying to fight them. As he'd said publicly on more than one occasion, the kingdom was committed now, whether wisely or not, and to pretend otherwise would have been treasonous. Of course, what he hadn't said aloud was that he was perfectly prepared to be treasonous, and he'd also followed through on his initial promises of support.